It's Monday, December 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a climate change agreement turns up political heat in Washington. Women vote for the first time in Saudi Arabia. Taiwan lights up controversy in the South China Sea.
They could be from Brazil, they could be from France, and they talk about when they were growing up, they used to listen to Frank Sinatra music on the radio.
Remembering Frank Sinatra on his 100th birthday. Also ahead, Golden Super Bowl music. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Americans are digesting a global climate accord that is dividing Washington along predictable partisan political lines. Congressional Democrats flooded Twitter to hail the accord, but not so by Republicans, who announced their opposition even before the deal was struck. But the Obama administration is standing firm, and the accord is sure to spark fierce debate as Congress reconvenes this week. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman warms us up in our studio with the latest.
Well, Jim, 2 weeks before Christmas, on a day when it was warm enough in Washington, D.C., where we could all wear short-sleeved shirts.
And some of us are.
And some of us have been all weekend long. It has been unseasonably warm and appropriate of that, Jim. There was indeed an accord announced in Paris, and President Obama made a rare Saturday statement before the cameras to say that this is the realization of a long-held goal of his and his administration to get the nations of the world together on a common concrete plan to stop the warming of the planet. Within seconds, it already ran into the buzzsaw of U.S. domestic politics.
You know, when you say something in this town, there's immediate reaction. And I would imagine it probably came from the Republican end of the scale.
Indeed. Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican Majority Leader, came out with a statement pointing out that America's adherence to this, America's contribution to this reduction in carbon emissions is all based on President Obama's domestic initiatives to rein in the burning of coal, to make cars more fuel efficient, and basically President Obama's entire domestic environmental agenda, which the Republicans have been fighting tooth and nail, particularly on the energy front. Taking the Obama administration to court, there are new regulations that are coming out, and Mitch McConnell points out that these are being contested domestically. And depending on how the courts rule and how this plays out, what Mr. Obama has pledged or what his administration has pledged in Paris might not come about. You have to understand that an accord like this is not a treaty. When the United States was negotiating nuclear treaties with the old Soviet Union, those were put before the Senate. They were ratified. This is more of an executive agreement type thing, which means that Mr. Obama doesn't have to submit it to Congress for anyone's approval, but it also means that whoever comes into the White House in 2017 can rip it up or can continue to adhere to this. So we are seeing yet another issue on which next year's presidential election could hinge.
The United States actually has a fairly long history now of environmental change through regulation. From the very first Earth Day back in 1970, we've seen dramatic changes in legislation. And, you know, I seem to recall periods of great economic boom in the United States from 1970 to now. Sure, we've had our downturns, but it seems to me that has had a pretty successful history so far.
Well, President Obama would point out that not only that, but that there are new economic opportunities to be seized in a clean energy future. Indeed, the United States has shrunk the rate of acceleration for carbon emissions. And I believe this year may actually have leveled off or started to decline ever so slightly. Many environmentalists point out that one of the simplest and easiest things that any government can do is simply to mandate better fuel economy for vehicles. These more fuel efficient cars would not be available in the numbers that they are available today were it not for government regulations telling car makers, domestic and foreign, if you want to sell cars, a certain number has to get a certain mileage.
We always have a wonderful climate here in the studio, sunny days when we get great analysis from Michael Bowman, our VOA Senate correspondent. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, it's time for us now to check out the reactions online. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here to tell us all about the climate tweets from relevant accounts. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. So there's a lot going on Twitter about Mr. Obama's remarks. So without further ado, let's go straight to the source. The president is on Twitter at POTUS. He tweeted this earlier Sunday. The strong Paris Agreement on climate means a safer, more secure world for our kids. A perfect example of what American leadership can do. He was praising the landmark agreement from the White House, of course, and the White House's Twitter account, at White House, is usually more active than the president's own account, and Sunday was not an exception. The White House sent out this tweet quoting the president. The agreement will mean less of the carbon pollution that threatens our planet. It retweeted a couple of tweets from Facts on Climate, which is run also by the White House. It also shared tweets from Vice President Joe Biden and Secretary of State John Kerry. Biden tweeted, "The Paris Agreement will improve the world our kids and grandkids will grow old in." And Kerry wrote, "World has chosen a smart, responsible path forward, and that the agreement is the strongest, most ambitious climate agreement ever negotiated."
Well, that's an historic move for sure. Mm-hmm. And what else is buzzing online, G?
Well, actually, there is another politician that's getting just as much, if not more, attention on the web. But in this case, it's for calling a Saudi Arabian prince, quote-unquote, dopey on social media. Now, for international listeners, I want to explain that the word means being stupefied by sleep or a drug or just being idiotic. We're talking about the GOP presidential hopeful Donald Trump, who tweeted this. "Dopey Prince Al-Waleed Talal wants to control our U.S. politicians with daddy's money. Can't do it when I get elected." That tweet got more than twice the number of retweets than President Obama's tweet on climate agreement. That was response to the Saudi Arabian billionaire's tweet that reads like this. "At real Donald Trump, you are a disgrace not only to the GOP, but to all of America. Withdraw from the U.S. presidential race as you will never win." Fun fact, Jim, Prince Talal is actually the one who Hoover dubbed Trump's assets when the American billionaire ran into cash flow problems back in the 1990s. Back to you.
Wow, fascinating. Thanks for that analysis, G. You can also follow us on the web at VOA_IE on Twitter. And G, of course, is on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Women have voted and run for office for the very first time in Saudi Arabia. The breakthrough came in municipal elections held across the kingdom. Edward Uranian has more for VOA from Cairo.
Across the kingdom, polling stations closed in the late afternoon Saturday, and observers in Riyadh, the Red Sea port city of Jeddah, and in Tabuk told the state television news channel Al Ikhbariya that vote counting began immediately. In the capital, local affairs minister Abdel Latif Al Sheikh emphasized that the municipal council elections marked the first time that women have been able to vote and also to run for office. In addition, he said the voting age has also been lowered to 18 and that the turnout by voters was encouraging. Thankfully, the minister said turnout has been good, according to reports he's seen. He views this as a sign of citizens' optimism and their understanding of the importance of the election. Reports from various polling stations appeared inconsistent, however. One observer in the capital claimed that more women turned out to vote than men, while a journalist in Jeddah told state TV that just 300 or 400 people voted out of 1,400 on the local electoral roll, and that most of them were men. One woman who voted said she did not see that giving women voting rights was a major development. This voter said she does not believe that it's a woman's place to run for office. She feels that men are better suited for a career in politics. Not all Saudi women agreed with that assessment, however. One woman who wanted to run for a council seat but was denied permission to do so told Al Hurra television that some women's names were mysteriously removed from official lists of candidates. She said she knows of at least four women who were dropped from lists of candidates and that it is not known why that happened. She contends that was a decision made on the national, not local level. Human Rights Watch reported it was difficult for women to register to vote, noting that women are not allowed to drive cars in Saudi Arabia. The rights group also said many polling stations were too far from women's houses. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Two Taiwan government officials have visited an islet in the heavily disputed South China Sea to kick off operations at a lighthouse. The trip is likely to irritate rival maritime claimants, China and Vietnam, but not touch off a major dispute. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA in Taipei.
Taiwan's Minister of the Interior and Coast Guard head flew to Taiping Island and back Saturday with a group of scholars. They attended a ceremony to start up a lighthouse that can guide ships up to 20 kilometers away. Taiwan controls Taiping, the biggest islet in the disputed ocean. The diplomatically isolated government wants its peers to respect Taiwan's maritime claims, but without causing upsets. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou has not ruled out a visit, but was not part of Saturday's trip. Raymond Wu, managing director of the political risk consultancy eTelligence in Taipei, said a presidential visit would have raised tough questions for the leader, who advocated in May that rival maritime claimants seek peace after four decades of bickering and occasional skirmishes.
Likely to receive a lot of public scrutiny domestically, and also there could potentially be a reaction by the country if Ma had gone. At this particular point, Taiwan wants to demonstrate that it's a constructive member of the region.
Brunei, China, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines also claim all or part of the South China Sea. China and Vietnam have been particularly aggressive in fortifying the approximately 500 islets in the 3.5 million square kilometer sea. China has angered other nations this year by landfilling its claims to expand its influence. The huge sea is rich in fisheries, commercial shipping lanes, and possibly fossil fuel reserves. Taiwan holds Taiping and one other islet in the Spratly Archipelago, which is surrounded by the bigger holdings of China, Malaysia, and Vietnam. President Ma's peace plan advocates that the rival government set aside sovereignty disputes and work jointly on resource exploration. Other governments dwarf Taiwan in terms of land claimed or diplomatic clout, so Taiwan has built up Taiping Island partly as an olive branch for the region. The government runs a pier and an airstrip on the tropical islet that's 1,400 meters long and 400 wide. It also operates a clinic for the crews of storm-battered ships from any country and has installed $1.29 million worth of solar panels since 2011 to showcase Taiping as a low-carbon island. Ralph Jennings for VOA News, Taipei.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents.
a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Before Frank Sinatra became a global household name, he was just a local boy from a small town across the river from Manhattan. To celebrate the 100th anniversary of his birth, his native Hoboken, New Jersey, has him on proud display. Ramon Taylor reports.
Hoboken, New Jersey has never forgotten its famous son. There is a street named after him. And now, for his 100th birthday anniversary, there is a Frank Sinatra exhibit at the local museum, featuring original footage courtesy of BBC.
I have tried, so tried not to give in.
We always hear from people, especially people who are not, you know, from the United States. They could be from Brazil, they could be from France. And they talk about when they were growing up, they used to listen to Frank Sinatra music on the radio. And they always loved the message of his music. They always felt connected to his voice.
Sinatra's velvety baritone talent brought him glamour and fame from New York to Hollywood, where he won numerous Grammys and an Oscar. Sinatra's is also an immigrant story.
He's growing up Italian at a time when Italians were still, you know, new to this country. And so he would talk about discrimination against Italians.
Sinatra spent his first 21 years in Hoboken in an Italian neighborhood. He sang in bars and played the ukulele. It is quite possible that Sinatra used to go to the riverbank and look across at the lights of the big city. It may have even inspired him to record a version of New York's most iconic tune.
New York, New York.
For reporters Victoria Kupchinetsky and Sergey Gusev, Ramon Taylor, VOA News, Hoboken, New Jersey.
One of the biggest annual music events is seen by about a billion people around the world, and it lasts for only 15 minutes. It's the U.S. National Football League's Super Bowl halftime show. And this year, there's an added buzz because it's the 50th Super Bowl. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us to unveil the headline act.
This is the golden anniversary Super Bowl, the 50th Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. So the National Football League is going to go all out. We now know who the headliner for the halftime show will be. It will be the English rock band Coldplay.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, Bruno Mars was the early favorite. And in fact, Bruno is going to be involved in this show. You might remember he put on a killer halftime show in 2014,
right,
along with his special guest, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Well, the Latin Times reports that Bruno will curate this Super Bowl 50 halftime show, and I take that to mean that he will likely perform, and he will also bring a bunch of big-name guest stars. Now, Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, is good friends with Jay-Z and Beyoncé. Beyoncé, of course, was the headliner at the 2013 Super Bowl.
Right.
So she's got plenty of Super Bowl experience.
And some accused her of knocking the lights out in that game.
Yeah, well, you know, there is that possibility. And Beyoncé also shows up on Coldplay's brand new seventh album, A Head Full of Dreams. So if you put everything together, I think a clearer picture emerges of what we can expect. Super Bowl 50 happens on February 7th, 2016 at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. For the past few years, this has been the trend with Super Bowl halftime shows, multi-artist extravaganzas.
The NFL, in the wake of the Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction, likes to have these things tightly choreographed.
Well, they've loosened up a bit. You might remember that immediately in the wake of the 2004 wardrobe malfunction, they had a series of classic rock artists, people like Paul McCartney and Tom Petty. Prince was in there. They would be what you might call safe choices.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Coldplay is a safe choice, too. Most likely, they had Katy Perry last year. it's going to be a real extravaganza, though. I think they're going to pull out all the stops for this one. I think Coldplay will sort of be the eye of the hurricane, so to speak.
Absolutely. And they love to also have a lot of acts before the game as well for the fans. If you actually go to the game, there's a lot going on musically.
Yeah, they've come a long way. The earliest Super Bowls had college marching bands
right.
for their halftime entertainment.
Right. And who could forget Up With People?
Up With People.
Yes, they did a couple halftime shows.
Way back in the 70s.
Yes.
I think the age of the modern Super Bowl halftime show began in 1993 when Michael Jackson was the feature performer.
I remember that one, and that was quite a spectacular. You can see that on YouTube, by the way, and, right. and looking at the old footage, wow, it's still a big halftime show.
Still holds up, and mm-hmm. things have never been the same since then.
Things that hold up here always is our Top 20 Countdown. We love to hear it every week. Ray McDonald is our host. Follow him on Twitter as well, Ray.
Ray on the hits.
That's all you need to know. Thanks for stopping by.
You got it, Jim.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, and we invite you to follow us at @VOA_IE. Our engineer is Daryl Smith. Tracy Carter is our director. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us and look forward to spending time with you again. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the Helsinki Final Act marks its 40th anniversary, it is critical that all members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe remain faithful to its core principles. These principles include recognizing the inherent dignity and human rights of every person, respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every participating state, and refraining from the threat or use of force across the OSCE region. In light of these commitments, the United States renews its call for Russia and the separatists that it backs to fully implement the Minsk agreements to which Moscow is a signatory. This includes the removal of Russian forces and equipment from eastern Ukraine and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has emphasized the importance of the Minsk agreement's provision for local elections in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to be carried out under Ukrainian law and subject to monitoring by the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. There must also be a return to Ukrainian control of the border and the release of all hostages detained for politically motivated reasons. Meanwhile, Ukraine needs to do its part by withdrawing its heavy weapons and to negotiate in good faith the Donbas election procedures. This is a time for concrete steps, said Secretary Kerry at the recent OSCE ministerial meeting in Serbia, and to avoid what is a disastrous but unnecessary conflict, and to begin the process of rebuilding Ukraine's east. Elsewhere in the OSCE, protracted conflicts continue in places like Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria, Georgia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. The protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms throughout the OSCE region continues to be a priority. In too many countries, said Secretary Kerry, non-governmental organizations are being restricted by new laws. Journalism is under attack, and the freedom of expression, including the media, is in jeopardy, sometimes by threat of force. There is no acceptable excuse for abusing the rights of citizens, for preventing journalists from doing their jobs, or from silencing legitimate political dissent. I hope that we will all reaffirm these fundamental ideals, said Secretary Kerry. The enduring promise of Helsinki should inspire all of us to tackle these shared challenges with renewed urgency and to continue our efforts in building a Europe and a Eurasia that is whole and free and at peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.